Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, this month marked another anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's death. It happened 161 years ago, and despite all of the scrutiny, there are still lingering questions. An author will take us back to the scene of the crime. This week in Illinois history remembers the fateful journey of the Donner Party, which left from Springfield. When behind bars, many incarcerated people take advantage of educational programs, but once they're released, it can be hard to continue their learning at colleges and universities. We'll have a report. We'll introduce you to a typewriter poet, and the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign is still looking for a mascot 20 years after Chief Alinawek was retired. That and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. In April 1865, the actor John Wilkes Booth sneaked into the presidential box at Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C. He placed a gun behind the head of Abraham Lincoln and pulled the trigger. Lincoln is remembered as a great president whose life was marked by America's war with itself and whose life came to an end just as peace was at hand. James Swanson wrote several books about Abraham Lincoln's death, including Manhunt and Chasing Lincoln's Killer. He spoke with Renee Montaigne on an earlier anniversary of Lincoln's death. We revisit that conversation.
600,000 Americans had died in the Civil War. That war was finally coming to an end. There'd be no more dying. And Lincoln was filled with joy.
Author James Swanson has written about one last shocking death, that of Abraham Lincoln himself. Here's an encore presentation of a visit we paid to Ford's Theater in 2009. We met Swanson there to trace the assassination of President Lincoln. On that spring night in 1865, the city of Washington, D.C. was celebrating.
Cannons, fireworks, torches, parades, people getting drunk in the streets, children running around carrying little flags, victory is ours, Richmond has fallen. Amidst all this joy and celebration, there was one man in Washington who was not happy at all, and that was the famous actor John Wilkes Booth.
Booth was a Confederate sympathizer who'd plotted with others to kidnap Lincoln, a plot that had come to nothing. And then a fateful bit of news came his way.
On the morning of April 14th, when he was reading his mail on the front steps of Ford's Theater, around noon, he heard the president was coming to the play that night. That's the moment he decided to kill Lincoln.
Just hours later, the actors came on stage at Ford's Theater to perform the comedy Our American Cousin. The president, along with Mrs. Lincoln, was late.
And he came up these stairs with his guests. When he arrived, the audience finally realized the president was here. And so the orchestra broke into a performance of Hail to the Chief, and the actor suspended the play and made a tribute to Lincoln. And it's up this very same route Booth came. With full view of the stage, full view of the performance, the sound of the theater, the laughter, and then Booth stopped.
A well-known, famous actor.
Yes. If Lincoln's box had been guarded properly, he could have said, I'm John Wilkes Booth. I want to greet the president, just the way a famous actor today might be able to greet the president at an important public event.
Why wasn't there anyone guarding President Lincoln? This was the end of a terrible Civil War. He had enemies.
One of the great mysteries of the assassination story in the whole Civil War is, why didn't Lincoln have proper guards? Lincoln was a fatalist. He thought, if someone wants to kill me, nothing can stop them. After he was shot, over 100 death threats were found in a cubbyhole in his desk. He knew he was a target.
So we are standing looking into the president's box, the very spot, the very seats that Lincoln sat in. This is a little vestibule. It's a private little place.
We're now experiencing just what John Wilkes Booth did. It was in this space in the dark that Booth waited, listening to the dialogue from the play. It was like a ticking clock. Four actors on stage now. Now three. Now two. Now only Harry Hawk alone stands on stage, and he's about to say a funny line that's going to cause the whole audience to break out in laughter, which Booth hopes will muffle the sound of his shot. Booth has in his left hand his bowie knife. In his right hand, he clutches the Derringer pistol. He hears that line, and he levels his right hand, and almost touches the back of Lincoln's head with the Derringer pistol and fires. Everything froze. The box took on a very devilish red color because of the artificial lights, the gas lamps, and the smoke, which was voluminous from a black powder weapon. Then one of the Lincoln's two theater guests, Major Rathbone, an Army officer, realized that's a gunshot. He rose up to grapple with Booth, and as soon as Rathbone looked up, he could see that knife coming down to kill him. Rathbone got his arm up just in time to parry the blow, but endured a deep cut. Booth sat on that balustrade. He swung one leg over, then the other. He jumped to the stage.
He would have to have been skilled because it's pretty far down there.
It's about an 11-foot drop. Then Booth ran to center stage. This was his final and greatest performance on the American stage. So he raised his bloody dagger in the air, and he cried out the state motto of Virginia, "Sic semper tyrannis, thus always to tyrants." And then he cried out, "The South is avenged." And just as he exited from the stage, he was heard distinctly to say, "I have done it." And then he vanished into the wings.
With John Wilkes Booth leading what would be a long chase into the countryside, President Lincoln was carried to the street, where a huge crowd had quickly collected.
So they're carrying the president in the middle of this street. He's dying. Thousands of people are standing here, and they don't know what to do with the president of the United States, who's just been shot through the head. Then across the street there, the Peterson boarding house, a man came out that front door holding a lamp and said, "Bring him in here."
Down this hall is the room that President Lincoln lay in that night.
The bed was too short, and his legs reached over the end of the bed. The doctor said, "Break the footboard off so the president can lie in the bed." It wouldn't come off. So the president had to be laid diagonally across what became the deathbed.
Abraham Lincoln died at 7:22 the next morning. James Swanson tells us that John Wilkes Booth had several motives to kill Lincoln: to avenge the defeated South, to inspire the Confederates to keep on fighting, and to win for himself fame and glory. Which is why 12 days later, when he was wounded and trapped by soldiers in a barn,
he performed his end. He was locked in the barn. They were outside. It was dark. He engaged them in Shakespearean dialogue. "Come on, I'll fight you one by one." He wanted to duel them. Finally, they had enough of it, and they set the barn on fire. The flames were like the stage lights, and they illuminated Booth for the final performance. He walked towards the front of the barn. He was going to walk out the door, and at that moment, one of the soldiers fired at Booth with his pistol. But even then, he wasn't dead. He was dragged to the front porch of the farm, and as the sun rose and shone upon his face, he looked at his hands and he produced the final benediction, not just on his life, but on his assassination and the entire plot. Booth's very last words were, "Useless, useless."
The author James Swanson discussing Abraham Lincoln's death that happened in April 1865. He spoke with Rene Montaigne. Swanson died last year. Most people tending America's farm fields were born elsewhere, yet farmers are having a harder time finding employees following the immigration crackdown. The Trump administration is trying to help by lowering wages for foreign guest workers, but changes to the H-2A visa program for guest workers is drawing fire from groups across the political spectrum. Frank Morris reports.
On a sprawling hay and row crop farm near Belleville, Kansas, three men replace worn parts on a huge green planter. They're Mexican citizens, and farmer Thane Larson appreciates their steady, diligent work.
Yeah, you didn't see one phone in anybody's hand trying, you know, looking at the social media or so. That's what you get, just work, work, work.
Larson hired these men and brought them to his farm after they obtained H-2A visas. He says they're absolutely critical to his operation because farm jobs are hard to fill.
Yeah, it's a frustrating part, and why we've had to try and really figure out the H-2A program, because you're not replacing, you know, workers here. They're just filling a void that you can't do. If you're going to be in this business, you got to find people.
Finding people is a huge issue in parts of rural America. That's fueled a fast expansion of the H-2A visa program. In the last two decades, it's exploded from about 50,000 workers to nearly 400,000. and draws people like Jose Reyes, who's worked on Larson's farm 15 years in a row.
Yeah, a lot of opportunities coming to work here legal and send some money to Mexico, support my family.
Larson says he could use a lot more H-2A workers, but he says the system's grown too complex and expensive. He says his total H-2A labor costs, including travel, paperwork, and housing, have risen to about $30 an hour on average. Larson's fine paying that much for valued employees like Reyes, but not for general farmhands. So he was glad when the Labor Department abruptly changed the way H-2A wages are calculated, cutting worker pay.
Absolutely, it needed to be happen, because you could not afford to pay. One size doesn't fit all.
The new rule also allows employers to start charging for housing that they had provided free of charge. For some foreign guest workers, it was a $5 an hour pay cut. The statute requires H-2A wages to be set high enough, but United Farm Workers President Teresa Romero says lowering guest worker pay also devalues American labor.
This is not something that is really taking care of American workers first.
The Farm Workers Union is suing to stop the administration's wage rule change, arguing it undercuts domestic farm workers, especially those without legal status.
What he's doing, you know, the deportations and the wage cuts are a one and two punch. You know, keep workers afraid as you lower their wages.
That describes a woman named Lourdes, who didn't want her last name used because she's in the U.S. illegally. Lourdes says she's long supported her kids working in the fields and greenhouses of eastern Colorado. Now she says those jobs are scarce.
Back when the tomato season was in full swing, they let a lot of people go, laid them off from their jobs in the tomato fields, because they started bringing in workers with work permits, known as H-2A visas.
Undocumented workers may be the most vulnerable to an influx of lower-paid guest workers, but U.S. citizens could suffer too. John Miano, with the Conservative Federation for American Immigration Reform, says cutting H-2A wages was a gift to farmers at the expense of the U.S. working class.
Basically, it provides a subsidy for employers to bypass the free market. I can go in and go for a massive pool of cheaper foreign labor that undermines Americans.
Well, the Farm Workers Union and immigration hardliners are pushing back on the administration's H-2A visa changes. Bipartisan legislation in Congress could expand the program. Bills in play would allow workers to stay longer and slow wage growth. I'm Frank Morris.
Protein is having its moment in the spotlight. Companies are adding more protein-enhanced products to their lineups as demand grows. The new federal dietary guidelines unveiled earlier this year also put the nutrient front and center. Tadeo Ruiz-Sandoval with Harvest Public Media reports on whether or not Americans actually need more protein.
It's not hard to find protein-packed foods. For years, consumers have enjoyed protein shakes, powders, and bars. But lately, it's been showing up in some surprising places.
Hello, welcome to Starbucks. What can I get started here today?
I'll do a vanilla protein latte.
Ooh, okay, so that protein, period. Okay, do you want a hotter ice today?
The company is just one of many that have introduced new lines of protein-enhanced products to meet increasing demand. A survey last year from the International Food Information Council found that 7 in 10 Americans want to include protein in their diets.
It's been picking up momentum in videos and TikTok.
Corey Geiger is a dairy economist for CoBank, a national lender. Geiger has studied the newfound appetite for protein. He says it's more than just a social media trend. It's now aligned with a political agenda.
Certainly, more recently, the MAHA movement has amplified what has been taking place in Americana.
The federal government unveiled new dietary guidelines in January that put protein front and center in the American diet. Officials say the new recommendations will, quote, make America healthy again. At a press conference announcing the changes, Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Marty McCary urged Americans to eat more protein.
The old guidelines had such a low protein recommendation that we are increasing that by 50 to 100%.
It's a change that dietitians across the country have mixed feelings about. Stanford University nutrition professor Christopher Gartner served on the board that made recommendations to the government. He says the administration largely ignored them, and he calls prioritizing protein bizarre.
Americans have been a little short on calcium, potassium, fiber, and vitamin D. Protein was not and has never been in that list of things that we're short of.
He points out that Americans are among the highest per capita consumers of protein-rich meat in the world. Cleveland Clinic dietitian Julia Zumpano says Americans are getting enough protein, mostly because they're consuming more calories than they need. Instead, she'd like Americans to be more mindful of where they get their protein.
Occasional red meat, an abundance of fish, poultry, a regular intake of legumes and beans. You know, eggs are infiltrated in there. The main source of dairy protein is in the form of yogurt.
Some nutrition experts think we do need more protein, like Stuart Phillips, a kinesiology professor at McMaster University in Canada. He agrees with the federal guidelines for protein intake. But Phillips thinks the new food pyramid overemphasizes the role protein should play in people's diets.
It's just that putting them on the top means that they should be eaten the most and more often. That's the sort of implication of the way the pyramid is based now. And that's not necessarily a good thing.
And he worries the new emphasis could encourage people to consume protein-enhanced products they don't need, especially if they don't exercise. Products, perhaps, like the latte I bought and am now about to enjoy. I'm Tadeo Ruiz Sandoval, Harvest Public Media.
Coming up, people in prison in Illinois say college programs have been life-changing for them, but when they get out, university admissions policies can make going back to school a challenge. That story and more on the way. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Piles of research have shown education leads to better outcomes for people getting out of prison and prevents them from going back. In Illinois, a small percentage of people in custody get to take college classes while they serve time. And when they do get out and want to continue their education, there's another barrier. They might encounter a criminal history review. That's a process universities say is about campus safety. For applicants with a record, it can feel like the door to higher ed was never really open. Charlotte West from our partner newsroom Open Campus has the story of one man's fight to get admitted to the school that already changed his life.
Almost every morning, Mike Pierce can be found sitting at the same table at the back of Intuition Coffee and Juice in downtown Peoria.
So I order multiple coffees at a time. So I normally get a drip and then a refill of a drip and then some sort of pastry as well.
Pierce walks here from a work release center two blocks away. He's still technically in the custody of the Illinois Department of Corrections, but he has a full-time job and gets to leave the facility. Before he came to Peoria, he spent about two decades in state prisons.
I was incarcerated in 2003. And in 2005 was sentenced to 23 years for murder.
In prison, he started to change his life. He took college classes, some with the University of Illinois through its Education Justice Project. Pierce says education gave him the space to reflect and to see the world differently than the way he'd been raised. He feels he owes everything to the mentors and professors he met in prison. So when Pierce neared the end of his sentence and got put on work release, there was no question. He wanted to go to graduate school, and he wanted to do it at University of Illinois. Pierce filled out an application for an online master's, but at the end, there was a surprise. A note that told applicants with criminal history to email an office on campus. He was being asked to check the box, in other words, to disclose his record.
I don't know who has access to that email address, who's going to read it. All I know is that my most intimate, life-changing moment has just been put out there into the ether to someone to judge.
What Pierce didn't know was that his disclosure would trigger a separate review by a committee that includes law enforcement and university leadership. The group can recommend barring someone from admission, regardless of how academically qualified they are for their program. And then, right before Christmas in 2024, while Pierce was getting ready for work, he got a letter back from the school.
I will say that I received this on a Friday night at 5 p.m. I was wearing a button-up shirt, black tie, getting ready to go serve and bus tables in a five-star restaurant. And I may have shed a few tears in a stairwell by myself when I read it. Thank you for applying to the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. The Student Discipline / Criminal History Review Committee from the Office of the Dean of Students has recommended that your application be denied. Illinois is committed to maintaining a safe environment for all members of the university community.
In other words, the same school that changed Pierce's life while he was serving time was now rejecting him because of that same prison sentence. The University of Illinois isn't alone. According to research by the Education Justice Project, 10 of the 12 public universities in Illinois ask applicants about their criminal history, and so do many private institutions. I spoke with researcher Ashton Kleekamp, who has studied this issue closely.
The vast majority of campus crimes are committed by people with no criminal history, and this sort of screening process does not actually support the goals it purports to.
And research indicates that just having the question on the application, having to check the box, is a barrier. A national study in 2015 found that 60% of undergraduate students with criminal histories stopped filling out the application when they came across that question.
It's easy when you're in prison to sit there and think, like, I'm a convict, you know, I have tattoos on my face or whatever, like, school's not for me.
Paul Calvo says he spent time in federal prison on drug and gang-related charges. Now, he's an electrical engineer, a Stanford graduate, and he applied to a master's program at U of I last fall. A few weeks after submitting, he got a letter, too. It congratulated him on getting cleared to continue the admissions process. But it also said that if Calvo attended the university, he would be on permanent conduct probation until he graduated.
The very first thing to, like, enter my mind was, like a sense of disappointment and, like, some hurt.
He thought about the good that he had done for his community in the years since his incarceration, tutoring local kids, teaching others who were still in prison.
It was like, forget about all that. We are going to focus on something that happened 18 years ago. Okay, cool. I'm going to withdraw my application. I don't want to hear from you guys anymore. Like, I'm done.
Calvo is going to the University of Texas at Austin in the fall. They never asked about his criminal history. But I asked him what it would mean if he had opted to continue his education at Illinois under probation.
I would feel like I was back in prison.
I described that sentiment to Bob Wilczynski. He's the chair of the committee at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign that reviews applicants' criminal histories. And Calvo's story made him pause.
They paid their debt to society and they felt like we punished them again. And that resonates with me. So what are ways in which we can send our message differently?
But Wilczynski points out that very few applicants get denied by his committee. Numbers from the most recent year available show 58 graduate applicants disclosed a criminal history. 47 were admitted without conditions. And Wilczynski says his focus is on the students who are already on campus.
A lot of times, Charlotte, I have to be selfish. I'm more focused on the community than I am about the applicant during the application process.
At the Peoria coffee shop, I shared Wilczynski's words with Mike Pierce.
Am I not a member of the community? It's an issue I have with people seeing those who are incarcerated as separate from society, especially since so many are going to eventually return home.
But Pierce's story didn't end with a denial. He appealed his rejection, and in January last year, he was accepted. The message he wants to share with other people who are incarcerated in Illinois, it's still worth it to apply.
I will say that the process has been complicated and heart-wrenching and ecstatic and all of the things that life tends to be. Yes, I'd love to see check the box go away. I'd love to see people considered on their merit before they're considered on their past. But I don't want people to be discouraged from trying. And I think that this journey that I'm on right now can be that positive encouragement to go ahead and try.
Now, most days, Pierce leaves his work release center, heads to the coffee shop, and goes to school, just like any other graduate student. I'm Charlotte West.
That story produced by Lauren Frost. It was a collaboration between member station WBEZ and Open Campus, a nonprofit newsroom that covers higher education. All of the approximately 150 city employees in Macomb recently underwent specialized training. It was designed to help them spot cases of human trafficking. Rich Egger has details.
City workers are out among the public daily, whether it's at City Hall or somewhere else in the community, so they're well positioned to spot something that might not seem right if they know what to look for. That's where this training comes in.
We train communities, whole communities of municipal workers, to look for these things, to have the eyes and ears on the community.
This is Carol Myrna. She's chief executive officer of the Peoria-based Center for Prevention of Abuse. She led the training sessions at Macomb City Hall.
So being educated to understand what are the right questions to ask, how do we identify somebody, how do we help them understand that they're a victim of exploitation, because many times they're being exploited by somebody that they know, maybe even love, and most certainly trust.
Myrna says FBI statistics show less than 1% of human trafficking involves abduction by a stranger. The vast majority of cases involve someone known to the victim. Traffickers use techniques such as brainwashing, mental manipulation, and threats of physical harm to control their victims. Myrna says the oldest client they have on file so far was 65. The youngest was 6.
It's tragic to believe that this happens to our young people, but 1 in 3 victims of human trafficking is a child.
Myrna says the center trains healthcare employees, first responders, hospitality workers, and fraternal organizations. They've even designed a curriculum for high school students. The center originally served a 46-county region in central Illinois, but Myrna says they've grown even beyond that large geographic area. She says in this region, they see more sex trafficking than labor trafficking, but nationally, the levels of both are about the same.
Exploitation is a low-risk, high-profit crime.
Myrna says labor trafficking is on the rise, so her organization is in the process of hiring a labor trafficking specialist. Macomb Mayor Mike Inman is a retired Illinois State Police investigator, and he encountered cases of human trafficking while on the job. So he knows the problem exists, and that's one reason he felt the training could be valuable for city workers. And he says after the training, some workers confirmed that.
Their awareness is already heightened as they leave this and thinking, you know, maybe this is real and we need to be more tuned in.
Inman thinks all municipalities, large and small, could benefit from the training. He says it could become annual training for city workers in Macomb. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security says human trafficking can happen in any community, and victims can be any age, race, gender, or nationality. The department calls human trafficking an underreported crime. Rich Egger reporting.
Across the U.S., lawmakers have introduced hundreds of bills limiting gender-affirming care and transgender people from public life. It's causing some to leave their homes in search of safer and more affirming communities. Sam Rink has the story of one person who chose Central Illinois as a destination. And a note to listeners, this story briefly mentions sexual violence.
Aaron Slayton lives and works at Five Acre Farm Daylilies a few miles outside Tolono with their husband, Jim Wersch. On this unseasonably warm November day, they take advantage of the weather to get some work done on the farm where they hope to install new sheds and fencing before next spring.
But what I'm working on over in this area and across here will be where new fencing will go.
Aaron initially came to Illinois from Tennessee this past January to help Jim deal with the grief of losing his late husband, Rod Cromer. And what was meant to be a short visit turned into a permanent move.
I technically never went back home after coming down.
Aaron is non-binary, and they say part of their decision to stay came from an increase in discrimination they experienced while living in Lebanon, Tennessee. A few years ago, they were raped and contracted HIV, which progressed into AIDS, but they weren't welcome at gendered support groups for victims of sexual violence. They were also turned away from food pantries operated by some Christian churches, and they were even harassed at a restaurant they frequented in Nashville.
There were a lot of times that I just didn't feel safe, so I kind of quit going.
They say the Trump administration's rhetoric has emboldened people to harass trans people in public.
They don't think that it is discrimination to blatantly say transphobic things. And so there were places in public settings where if somebody recognized me as being trans, it was putting me in danger because they felt a need to throw me out of whatever public place I was in because I didn't belong, because somehow I was a threat.
A recent survey conducted by the Williams Institute, a think tank at the UCLA School of Law, suggests Aaron's experience isn't uncommon. Almost half of transgender, non-binary, and gender-diverse U.S. adults say they'd considered moving or had already moved to a more trans-affirming place. But it can be even harder for children and teens who are trans because of tighter restrictions in many states. And Illinois has become a target destination for some of their families as one of four Midwestern states that has not banned gender-affirming care for minors. Asher McMaher is executive director of Trans Upfront Illinois, a nonprofit that advocates for trans people from ages 4 to 25.
Our organization serves anyone in the state or anyone who comes into the state to access care. Right now, we serve about 900 families. About 250 of those are from surrounding states.
They say parents are worried about their children's safety
and their ability and access to get health care, because we know gender-affirming care is life-saving. And they're worried that they're going to lose their child.
But even in a state with trans-affirming laws, federal orders can still make it difficult for people here, especially minors, to access certain kinds of care. Joshua Gavel is the executive director of Uniting Pride of Champaign County.
It's really scary right now, the stuff that they're doing at the federal level to specifically go after hospitals and threaten millions of dollars in funding and needed funding, especially for like rural hospitals.
Just this February, Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago announced it would pause gender care surgeries for people under 19 after threats to funding from the Trump administration. And Gavel says with care getting more difficult to access,
it's a tough situation, and I think we're going to see families making hard choices for a while.
But he says healthcare isn't the only thing that draws trans people to the state.
In this community, especially Champaign-Urbana, like proper, there are so many affirming partners here.
He says the schools are a big motivation, and it's no secret Champaign-Urbana is more affordable than a major city like Chicago. Gavel also says queer-friendly faith spaces have drawn people to the area, including the Unitarian Universalist Church of Urbana-Champaign, where Aaron and Jim volunteer almost every Sunday.
It has really helped me to be able to sort of act as a segue into the wider community.
The UU Church in Urbana is a trans-affirming congregation that regularly participates in protests, pride events, and has social justice as one of its eight core principles of belief. Here, Aaron is free to openly identify as non-binary and express their gender as well as practice their pagan beliefs in community with others. They say what the church offers is more than just empty words.
What will make a difference and what will impact people is knowing that they have a community that actually cares about them.
I'm Sam Rink, IPM News.
More to come on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. In this glued-to-your-phone era of technological isolation from our fellow human beings, one creative person is turning to old technology to help people reconnect and spread joy and a little art. Charlie Schlinker reports on a typewriter poet.
Athena Pyer of Bloomington is using typewriters to craft custom poetry outside a downtown Bloomington bookstore for tips. It's an unusual business model.
A turtle wakes from a nap at the bottom of an ancient pond. The wind disturbs a leaf from a tree above, and as the turtle breaks the surface, the leaf lands on his nose.
Pyer says at the beginning of summer, she was really bored, felt disconnected from her roots in literature, needed extra money, and was trying to internalize her mom's lessons about entrepreneurship. Combining all these was a challenge.
I kind of took a drastic measure and bought typewriters, and they're kind of expensive, so there was no going back. I need to do something with these typewriters.
She picked typewriters for this new venture because there's something about putting the ink on the paper and not having the ability to take it back the same way you can on a computer. Sure, there's correction tape, but generally once the letter's on the page, it's there. The permanence matters. Pyer says it's liberating.
We live in an age with a lot of anxiety and over-editing, and we doubt ourselves a lot. And whenever you're typing on a typewriter, especially for somebody, you are as truthful as you can be right away. And that's pretty powerful.
She says that's good for the craft of poetry. The authenticity makes a difference. Communication theorist Marshall McLuhan famously said, "The medium is the message," because technology influences the scale and form of human connection. McLuhan's ghost is probably faintly smiling at this point, because for Pyer, the medium does shape the message.
What we're doing is writing with typewriters in a very public setting. We are interacting with people, and it can be kind of overwhelming, kind of overstimulating in a way, but it gives an energy of life to the poem.
Writers yearn to impact people with their words. Pyer says something about using the typewriter, seeing the font on the page, and feeling the nostalgia of these antiquated machines brings out emotions in her audience, too.
Some people smile whenever they see their poem, and some people, we've made people cry. Sometimes tears of joy, sometimes it just brings up a lot for people, and that's pretty special.
On this day, Pyer is up to 10 poems in about 3 hours.
I just start typing away, writing something. Usually it's a haiku piece, and I start to lay the poems out in front of me. I let the sound of the typewriters go through the street. That piques people's curiosity. They kind of slowly start to trickle up to me and start asking, "Hey, what's going on?"
Almost always a child walks by and asks to try the typewriter. She lets them. Letting the poems loose in the world, she says, adds to humanity, one drop of ink and one key snap at a time.
Having art in a public setting is incredibly important just for people's well-being. I think having art, literature, being accessible in a community is a sign of strength and openness in communities, and we need that. Desperately.
A woman comes by to pick up a poem Pyer has written for her infant daughter. She declines an interview, but lets Pyer give voice to the work.
Toddling along, please know you are loved. Even when you stumble and I am not there to kiss your scraped knee, please know I care. As the wind catches your hair on a sunny day, I am reminded of all the dreams you made come true. My beautiful pearl, please know
our love will always be true. So toddle around the world with your precious smile and bring your heart with you too, because the world needs more like you.
Pyre owns 7 functional manual typewriters, a couple more electrics, and one broken one from the year 1908 she just can't let go. She has 2 with her on this day. One is a powder blue Royal, the other a green Consul. Does she have a favorite?
They're my children. I can't say that in front of them.
One of the typewriters has a lot of ink on its ribbon. The other has keys that produce a clean cursive script. Pyre favors the inky one to write haiku.
Because it reminds me of Asian calligraphy. That's kind of a personal choice, but sometimes whenever I come to different locations, if I'm by myself, I will bring as many typewriters as I can carry.
She says the weight of the keys or the font or something else about them might inspire different styles of poetry to match with people who hunger for words. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Welcome to This Week in Illinois History. I'm Clint Cargow. The Donner Party. Everyone's familiar with the story, but few remember that their ill-fated journey began in Springfield, Illinois. It was April 15, 1846, when brothers George and Jacob Donner, wealthy farmers who lived east of Springfield, departed that city with their families and other immigrants to resettle in California. They left with the Reed family. James Reed was a businessman who had served with Abraham Lincoln in the Black Hawk War. Mary Lincoln was in the crowd behind the state capitol building that day to bid farewell to the 32 travelers. Many of them had deep ties to the area, and friends and family were sad to see them go. The Donner Party followed a popular route west and picked up more families along the way. George Donner was named captain of the group, which is why the party of multiple families from multiple states carried his name. The choice to veer off on an untested new route ultimately doomed them. Early snowstorms and impassable terrain trapped them high in the Sierra Nevada mountains. As food and supplies dwindled, some members resorted to eating the dead. It took 4 months for search expeditions to extract all the survivors. Of the 87 pioneers who sought their future in California, only 48 survived. Today, a bronze plaque in Springfield's Lincoln Square marks the point where the Donner Party departed on their tragic trip. I'm Clint Cargow, and that's This Week in Illinois History.
A pair of bills in the Illinois legislature could bring autonomous vehicles to Illinois. Isabella Nieto has more in this report.
The Autonomous Vehicle Pilot Project Act would create guidelines for self-driving vehicle testing on Illinois roads. The proposed bills would gear the pilot toward counties with at least 1 million residents. Teamsters and other labor unions visited Springfield Tuesday to lobby against the legislation. Rashonda Hudson is a member of Chicago-based Teamsters Local 727.
We always have construction, unpredictable traffic, tight streets, and let's not talk about the weather. When something goes wrong with a robot, how's it going to be resolved?
Each bill is still moving through the House and Senate. I'm Isabella Nieto.
Years ago, the NCAA told the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign it could not bring out Chief Illiniwek at championship games. It said the fictional chieftain was hostile to indigenous communities. The U of I retired the chief, but it still has not picked a new mascot. Other schools have moved on. Native American faculty say the inaction is damaging the campus community. Emily Hayes reports some students are trying to fill the void.
Students are lining up to take pictures with the kingfisher. The 6-foot bird costume matches U of I's school colors.
She's naturally true to the orange and blue.
Claudia Babel is a sophomore at U of I. She's the social media coordinator for the King's Guard, the student club pushing to make the belted kingfisher the school's new mascot.
They're native to Illinois and North America, but kingfishers are found all over the world, just like our students are.
During student elections in 2020, a majority supported the idea. Faculty and the University Senate followed soon after. But university spokesperson Pat Wade says U of I is looking for a new mascot that demonstrates it can bring the community together. And it hasn't seen one yet that clearly meets that standard. Meanwhile, the old athletic symbol persists. There are statues of the fictional Chief Illiniwek at some local bars. Babel says at sporting events, dads sometimes shout at the student in the kingfisher costume. Native American students and faculty at U of I have called on the university to discard the old mascot for decades. The chief last appeared at a 2007 basketball game.
It's a halftime tradition going back 81 years. The marching Illini strike up the 3-1.
Students dressed as the mascot would wear a long feathered headdress and face paint. Supporters said the regalia honored Native Americans, but that wasn't how Native students and faculty saw it. Joseph Gaughan is a member of the Anishinaabe tribal nation in Montana and a professor at Harvard University. In the 90s, he was a PhD student at U of I.
We made the rounds and made all the arguments and offered the best rationales.
Research shows Native youth who are exposed to Native American mascots have shortened dreams and ambitions for their future. Gaughan and half a dozen other Native students believed they could educate the higher-ups on campus and get the Board of Trustees to eliminate the mascot.
Many of the people we talked to privately acknowledged that those rationales and arguments made sense to them, but that they were powerless to do anything.
It took a threat from the National Collegiate Athletic Association to push U of I to change. The school tried to appeal the policy on racist mascots twice and lost in April 2006. Political winds have shifted since that ruling 20 years ago. President Trump threatened to hold up the Washington Commanders' plans to build a new stadium last year if the team didn't revert to its previous name. And he has an ally in the Native American Guardians Association.
My mom always taught us to be very proud to be the real Redskins. And if anyone was going to be offended by being the Redskins, it would be my mom.
Becky Clayton Anderson is a president of NAGA. She's an enrolled member of the Hidatsa in North Dakota. She grew up in central Illinois and went to Sullivan High School, where the sports teams are the Redskins. The group has released statements and petitions in support of Trump. The Department of Education has supported NAGA's latest lawsuit.
We're one step away from the Supreme Court, where we will win, showing that people trying to eliminate Native American names and images is discrimination against a race.
Clayton Anderson says NAGA's next step is to go back state by state to make schools reinstate names and images like Chief Illiniwek. But many schools have moved on, and some administrators say they don't want to go back. Brad Bobo is Associate Athletic Director for Marketing at Arkansas State University. He's proud to have graduated from the school when the students were the Indians. But he says the old mascot had its own challenges.
You were so mindful about not being disrespectful to Native Americans that honestly you were a little bit handcuffed from a marketing and a licensing standpoint by what you could do with that nickname.
The NCAA listed Arkansas State among 18 universities with hostile mascots. When bigger schools lost their appeals, Arkansas decided to change. The sports teams became the Red Wolves, and Bobo says the new mascot didn't lead to any decline in alumni donations.
Even though you don't like being told you got to do something, changing, I would tell you, changing was the best thing for us.
Community members at U of I hope the school can take a similar step, because they say not having a new mascot continues to harm Native Americans on campus.
They could care less about us.
Jackie Rand is an American Indian Studies professor at the school and a citizen of the Choctaw Nation in Oklahoma. She says administrators still show hostility towards Native students and faculty.
They have letters from faculty in their offices that say, "This is very disturbing. I can't believe I have to work here in these conditions."
Rand was pushed out as Vice Chancellor of Native Affairs 2 years ago without much explanation. U of I spokesperson Pat Wade says student affairs and civil rights administrators are meeting now to advise the university's new chancellor about future directions for the role. Rand says the lingering presence of Chief Illiniwek makes it hard to hire Native American faculty.
So instead of having like a legit real mascot, we've got this ghost mascot that just hovers.
In the meantime, the Kingfisher is ready to step up. Whether it's outside Memorial Stadium during a football game or celebrating the Illini's Elite Eight basketball win, the mascot is trying to unite the campus. I'm Emily Hayes.
That's all the time we have for Statewide. Thanks for joining us. Be with us again next time. We'll return with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.